This is part 7 of Christianity as Mystical Fact by Rudolf Steiner, beginning with chapter 10, Jesus and His Historical Background. In the wisdom of the mysteries is to be sought the soil out of which grew the spirit of Christianity. All that was needed was the spread of the fundamental conviction that this spirit must be introduced into life in greater measure than had been done through the mysteries. But such a conviction was already widespread, as may be seen from the manner of life of the Essenes and Therapeutae, who existed long before Christianity arose. The Essenes were an exclusive sect, living in Palestine, whose numbers at the time of Christ were estimated at about 4,000. They formed a community which required that its members should lead a life calculated to develop a higher self within the soul, thus bringing about a rebirth. The aspirant for admission was subjected to a severe test in order to ascertain whether he were ripe enough to prepare himself for a higher life. If he was admitted, he had to undergo a period of probation and to take a solemn oath that he would not betray to strangers the secrets of the Essenian discipline. The object of this life was the conquest of the lower human nature, so that the spirit latent within the soul might be awakened ever more and more. Anyone who had experienced up to a certain point the spirit within him was raised to a higher grade and enjoyed a corresponding degree of authority, not imposed from without, but conditioned by the nature of the fundamental principles. Akin to the Essenes were the Therapeutae, who dwelt in Egypt. We get abundant details concerning their mode of life in a treatise by the philosopher Philo on the contemplative life. Footnote: the dispute as to the authenticity of this work must now be regarded as settled, and it may be rightly assumed that Philo really described the life of a community existing long before Christianity and well known to him. End footnote. A few passages from Philo's treatise will give an idea of the main tenets of the Therapeutae. Quote, "The dwellings of the members of the community are extremely simple, affording only the necessary shelter from extreme heat and cold. The dwellings are not built close together as in towns, for contiguity has no attraction for one who seeks solitude. Nor are they at a great distance one from another, in order that the social relations so dear to them may not be made difficult, and that they may easily be able to assist each other in case of an attack by brigands. In each house is a consecrated room called a temple or monasterion, a small chamber or cell in which the mysteries of the higher self are cultivated. They also possess works by ancient authors who once directed their school and left many explanations about the customary method used in allegorical writings. Their interpretation of sacred writings is directed to the deeper meaning of allegorical narratives." End quote. From this we see that what had been striven after in the narrower circle of the mysteries was being made universal. But such a procedure naturally relaxed the austerity of the character of the mystery strivings. The Essene and therapeutic communities form a natural transition from the mysteries to Christianity. But Christianity wished to extend to humanity in general what, with the Essenes and Therapeutae, was the affair of a sect. This Christian attitude, of course, prepared the way for a still further diminution of the original severity. The existence of such sects makes it possible to understand how far the time was ripe for the comprehension of the mystery of Christ. In the mysteries, a man was artificially prepared for the dawning in his consciousness, at the appropriate time, of an awareness of the spiritual world. Within the community of the Essenes or Therapeutae, it was by an appropriate mode of life that the soul sought to become ripe for the awakening of the higher man. A further step forward is that man struggles through to a feeling that a human individuality may have evolved to higher and higher stages of perfection in repeated earth lives. One who had arrived at a glimpse of this truth would also be able to feel that in Jesus a being of lofty spirituality had appeared. The loftier the spirituality, the greater the possibility of accomplishing something of importance. Thus the individuality of Jesus could become capable of accomplishing the deed which the evangelists so mysteriously indicate in the baptism by John, and which, by the way, in which they speak of it, they so clearly point out as of the utmost importance. The personality of Jesus became able to receive the Christ into its own soul, the Logos, who was made flesh in that soul, Thenceforward the ego of Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ, and the outer personality was the vehicle of the Logos. The event of the ego of Jesus becoming the Christ is enacted in the baptism by John. During the period of the mysteries, union with the Spirit was only for those who were to be initiated. Among the Essenes, a whole community cultivated a life by means of which all its members were able to attain to the mystical union. In the coming of Christ, something, namely his deeds, was placed before the whole of humanity so that it might share in the mystical union. The end of chapter 10. Chapter 11. The Nature of Christianity. The deepest effect must have been produced upon believers in Christianity by the fact that the divine, the Word, the eternal Logos no longer came to them in the dim twilight of the mysteries as spirit only, but that when they spoke of the Logos they were made to think of the historical human personality of Jesus. Formerly the Logos had been materially seen only in different degrees of human perfection. The delicate, subtle differences in the spiritual life of personalities could be observed, and the manner and degree in which the Logos came alive within those seeking initiation. A higher degree of maturity was to be intercepted as a higher stage, a higher degree of maturity was to be interpreted as a higher degree of evolution of spiritual life. The preparatory steps had to be sought in a spiritual life already passed through, and the present life was to be regarded as the preparatory stage for future degrees of spiritual evolution. The conservation of the spiritual force of the soul and the eternity of that force could be asserted in the words of the Jewish occult teaching in the book of Zohar, quote, "Nothing in the world is lost, nothing falls prey to the void, not even the words and voice of man. Everything has its place and purport." Any given personality was but one metamorphosis of the soul that develops from one personality to another. The single life of a personality was only considered as a link in the chain of development stretching backward and forward. This Logos, transforming itself within the many single human personalities, has through Christianity been directed away from these to the one unique personality of Jesus. What had previously been distributed throughout the world was now united in one unique personality. Jesus became the unique God-man. In Jesus something was present, once which must appear to man as the greatest of ideals, and with which, in the course of man's repeated lives, he should unite himself more and more. Jesus took upon himself the divinization of the whole of humanity. In him was sought what formerly could only be sought in one's own soul. One no longer beheld the divine and eternal within the personality of a man. All that was now beheld in Jesus. It is not the eternal part of the soul that conquers death and will one day rise through its own power as the divine, but it is that which was in Jesus, the one God, who will appear and raise the souls of men. It follows from this that an entirely new meaning was given to personality. The eternal, immortal aspect had been taken from it. Only the personality as such was left. If immortality were not to be denied, it had to be ascribed to this personality itself. Out of the belief in the soul's eternal metamorphosis arose the belief in personal immortality. Personality acquired infinite importance because it was the only thing left to man. Henceforth there is nothing between personality and the infinite God. A direct relation with him must be established. Man was no longer capable of becoming divine himself in a greater or lesser degree. He was simply man, standing in a direct but outward relation to God. This brought quite a new note into the conception of the world for those who knew the point of view held in the ancient mysteries. There were doubtless many people in this position during the first centuries of Christianity. They knew the nature of the mysteries. If they wished to become Christians, they were obliged to come to an understanding with the old order. This must have brought about most difficult conflicts within their souls. They doubtless sought in every way to harmonize the two tendencies in the conception of the world. This conflict is reflected in the writings of early Christian times, in those of pagans attracted by the sublimity of Christianity, as well as in the writings of those Christians who found it hard to give up the ways of the mysteries. Slowly did Christianity grow out of these mysteries. On the one hand, Christian convictions were presented in the form of the mystery truths, and on the other, the mystery wisdom was clothed in Christian words. Clement of Alexandria, a Christian writer whose education had been pagan, is an instance of this. Quote, "God has not forbidden us to rest from good deeds when keeping the Sabbath. He permits those who can grasp them to share in the divine mysteries and in the sacred light. He has not revealed to the masses what is not suitable for them, but only to a few whom he judged able to grasp it and to work out in themselves the unspeakable mystery which God confided to the Logos, not to the written word. And God hath set some in the church as apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ." Unquote. Individual souls in those days sought by very different paths to find the way from the ancient views to the Christian ones, and the one who thought he was on the right path called others heretics. In the meanwhile, the church grew stronger and stronger as an outward institution. The more power it gained, the more did the path recognized as the right one by the decisions of councils take the place of personal research. It was for the church to decide who deviated too far from the divine truth which she guarded. The idea of a heretic took firmer and firmer shape. During the first centuries of Christianity, the search for the divine path was a much more personal matter than it afterward became. A long distance had been travelled before the conviction of Augustine became possible. Quote, "I should not believe in the truth of the Gospels unless the authority of the Catholic Church forced me to do so." Unquote. The conflict between the method of the mysteries and that of the Christian religion acquired a special stamp through the various Gnostic sects and writers. We may class as Gnostics all the writers of the first Christian centuries who sought for a deep spiritual meaning in Christian teachings. Footnote: a brilliant account of the development of the Gnosis is given in G.R.S. Meade's book mentioned above, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten. We understand the Gnostics when we look upon them as saturated with the ancient wisdom of the mysteries and as striving to understand Christianity from that point of view. For them, Christ was the Logos, and as such primarily of a spiritual nature. In his primal essence, he cannot reach man from without. He must be awakened in the soul. But the historical Jesus must bear some relation to the spiritual Logos. This was the crucial point for the Gnostics. Some settled it in one way, some in another, but the essential point common to them all was that to arrive at a true understanding of the Christ idea, mere historical tradition was not enough, but that it must be sought either in the wisdom of the mysteries or in the Neoplatonic philosophy, derived from the same source and flourishing in the early Christian centuries. The Gnostics had confidence in human wisdom and believed it capable of bringing forth a Christ by whom the historical Christ could be measured. In fact, through whom alone the latter could be understood and beheld in the right light. Of special interest from this point of view is the doctrine given in the books of Dionysius the Areopagite. It is true that there is no mention of these writings till the 6th century, but it matters little when and where they were written, the point being that they give an account of Christianity which is clothed in the language of the Neoplatonic philosophy and presented in the form of a spiritual contemplation of the higher world. At all events, this is a form of delineation that belongs to the first Christian centuries. In older times, the truth was handed on in the form of oral tradition. The most important things were never entrusted to writing. The Christianity described in the writings of Dionysius is set forth in the mirror of the Neoplatonic conception of the world. Sense perception dims man's spiritual vision. He must reach out beyond the senses. But all human concepts are primarily derived from sense observation. What man perceives with his senses he calls existent. What he does not thus perceive he calls non-existent. If, therefore, he wishes to open up an actual view of the divine, he must rise above existence and non-existence, for these also, as he conceives them, have their origin in the sphere of the senses. In this sense, God is neither existent nor non-existent. He is super-existent. Consequently, he cannot be reached by means of ordinary cognition, which has to do with existing things. We must be raised above ourselves, above our sense observation, above our reasoning logic, if we are to find the way to a spiritual vision. Thence we are able to get a glimpse into the perspectives of the divine. But this super-existent divinity had brought forth the Logos, the basis of the universe, filled with wisdom, and even the small powers of man can reach him. He appears in the cosmos as the spiritual Son of God. He is the mediator between God and man. He may be present in man in varying degrees. He may be realized in an external institution, in which those diversely imbued with his spirit are grouped into a hierarchy. A church of this kind is the outer reality of the Logos, and the power that lives in it lived in a personal way, in the Christ become flesh, in Jesus. Thus the church is, through Jesus, united to God. Jesus is its culmination and its meaning. One thing was clear to all Gnosis, that it must come to an understanding about the personality of Jesus. Christ and Jesus must be brought into relationship with one another. Divinity had been taken from human personality, and must in one way or another be recovered. It must be possible to find it again in Jesus. The mystic was concerned with the degree of divinity within himself and with his earthly personality. The Christian was concerned with the latter, and also with a perfect God, exalted above all that is attainable by humanity. If we hold firmly to this point of view, a fundamental mystic attitude of the soul is only possible when the soul's spiritual eyes are opened, when, through finding higher spiritual possibilities within herself, the soul throws herself open to the light which issues from the Christ in Jesus. Union of the soul with her highest powers is at the same time union with the historical Jesus. For mysticism is the direct consciousness and feeling of the divine within the soul. But a God so far transcending everything human can never dwell in the soul in the real sense of the word. The Gnosis and all subsequent Christian mysticism represents the effort in some way or other nevertheless to lay hold of that God, and to apprehend him directly in the soul. A conflict in this was inevitable. It was really only possible for a man to find his own divine part, but this is both human and divine, the divine at a certain stage of development. Yet the Christian God is a definite one, perfect in himself. It was possible for a person to find in himself the power to strive upward to this God, but he could not characterize what he experienced in his own soul at any stage of development as being one with God. An abyss opened between that which it was possible to find in the soul and that which Christianity called divine. It is the abyss between knowledge and faith, between cognition and religious feeling. This chasm cannot exist for the mystic in the old sense of the word, for he knows that he can only comprehend the divine by degrees, and he also knows why this is so. It is clear to him that this gradual attainment is a real attainment of divine life, and he finds it difficult to speak of a perfect, finished divine principle. A mystic of this kind does not seek a perfect God. He seeks to experience the divine life. He seeks to be made divine himself, not to gain an external relation to the Godhead. It lies in the nature of Christianity that its mysticism is not in this sense void of presuppositions. The Christian mystic seeks to behold divinity within himself, but at the same time he must look up to the historical Christ, just as his physical eyes look up to the sun, S-U-N. Just as the forces of the physical eyes behold physical objects through the power of the sun, so does the Christian mystic's intensified inner soul force behold the divine through the light that is shed by the appearance of Christ. He is. This enables me to rise to the highest in me. It is in this way that the Christian mystics of the Middle Ages differ from the mystics of the ancient mysteries. The end of chapter 11. Chapter 12. Christianity and Pagan Wisdom. At the time of the primal beginnings of Christianity, there appear in antique pagan culture conceptions of the universe which present a continuation of the Platonic philosophy, and which may also be taken as a deepening and spiritualization of the wisdom of the mysteries. They began with Philo of Alexandria, 25 BC to 50 AD. From his point of view, the processes leading to the divine take place in the innermost part of the human soul. We might say that the temple in which Philo seeks initiation is solely his inner being and its spiritual experiences, and processes of a purely spiritual nature replace the initiatory ceremonies of the sanctuary. According to Philo, sense observation and knowledge gained through the logical intellect do not lead to the divine. They are merely to do with what is perishable. But there is a way by which the soul may rise above these methods. She must leave what she calls her ordinary self, must be lifted out of it. Then she enters a state of spiritual exaltation and illumination, in which she no longer knows, thinks, and learns in the ordinary sense of the words, for she has become merged, identified with the divine. The divine is experienced in its essence, which cannot be fashioned in thoughts nor communicated in concepts. It is experienced. And one who goes through this experience knows that he can speak about the divine only if he is able to imbue his words with life. The visible world is an image of this mystic reality experienced in the inmost recesses of the soul. The world has come forth from the invisible, inconceivable God. The harmony of the cosmos, which is steeped in wisdom and to which sense phenomena are subject, is a direct reflection of the Godhead, its spiritual image. It is divine spirit poured out into the world, cosmic reason, the Logos, the offspring or son of God. The Logos is the mediator between the world of sense and the unimaginable God. By steeping himself in cognition, man unites with the Logos. The Logos becomes embodied in him. The person who has developed spirituality is the vehicle of the Logos. Above the Logos is God. Beneath is the perishable world. It is man's vocation to form the link between the two. What he experiences in his inmost being as spirit is the universal spirit. Such ideas are directly reminiscent of the Pythagorean manner of thinking. The center of existence is sought in the inner life. Out this life is conscious of its import. St. Augustine was thinking in virtually the same way as Philo when he said, quote, "We see all created things because they are, but they are because God sees them," unquote. And he adds concerning what and how we see, quote, "And because they are, we see them outwardly. Because they are perfect, we see them inwardly," unquote. Plato has the same fundamental idea. Like Plato, Philo sees in the destiny of the human soul the consummation of the great cosmic drama, the awakening of the divinity that is under a spell. He thus describes the inner actions of the soul. The wisdom of man's inner being emulates the ways of the Father, quote, "emulates the ways of the Father and shapes the forms by beholding the archetypes," unquote. It is accordingly no personal matter for man to create forms in his inner being. They are eternal wisdom. They are cosmic life. This is in harmony with the interpretation of the myths of the people in the light of the mysteries. The mystic searches for the heart of truth in the myths, and as the mystic treats the myths of paganism, Philo handles the mosaic story of the creation. The Old Testament accounts are for him images of inner soul processes. The Bible relates the creation of the world. One who takes it merely as a description of outer events knows but half of it. It is certainly written, quote, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters." But the real inner meaning, end quote, but the real inner meaning of such words must be experienced in the depths of the soul. God must be found within. Then he appears as the, quote, "primal splendor, who sends out innumerable rays, not perceptible by the sense, but wholly thought," unquote. This is Philo's expression. In the Timaeus of Plato, the words are almost identical with those in the Bible. Quote, "Now when the Father who had created the universe saw how it had become living and animated and an image of the eternal gods, he felt pleasure therein," unquote. In the Bible we read, quote, "And God saw that it was good," unquote. The recognition of the divine is for Philo as well as for Plato. And in the Wisdom of the Mysteries, to experience the process of creation as the destiny of one's own soul. The history of creation and the history of the soul who is becoming divine in this way flow into one. Philo is convinced that the Mosaic account of the creation may be used for writing the history of the soul who is seeking God. Everything in the Bible thereby acquires a profoundly symbolical meaning, of which Philo becomes the interpreter. He reads the Bible as history of the soul. We may say that Philo's manner of reading the Bible corresponds to a feature of his age that originated in the wisdom of the mysteries. He even relates that the Therapeutae interpreted ancient writings in the same way. Quote, "They also possess works by ancient authors who once directed their school and left behind many explanations about the customary method pursued in allegorical writings. The interpretation of such writings is directed to the inner meaning of the allegorical narratives." Unquote. Thus, Philo's aim was to discover the deeper meaning of the quote-unquote allegorical narratives in the Old Testament. Let us try to realize whither such an interpretation could lead. We read the account of creation and find in it not only a narrative of outward events, but an indication of the way the soul must take in order to attain to the divine. The soul must reproduce in herself the ways of God microcosmically, and in this alone can her striving for wisdom consist. The cosmic drama must be enacted in each individual soul. The inner life of the mystic sage is the realization of the model given in the account of the creation. Moses wrote not only to relate historical facts, but to represent pictorially the paths the soul must travel if it would find God. All this in Philo's world conception is enacted within the human soul. Man experiences within himself what God has experienced in the universe. The word of God, the Logos, becomes an event in the soul. God brought the Jews from Egypt into Palestine. He caused them to suffer distress and privation before giving them that land of promise. That is the outward event. Man must experience it inwardly. He goes from the land of Egypt, the perishable world, through the privations that lead to the suppression of the sense nature, into the promised land of the soul. He attains to the eternal. In Philo's philosophy, all that is an inner process. The man who poured himself forth into the world consummates his resurrection in the soul when that soul undertakes his creative word and echoes it. Then man has spiritually given birth within himself to divinity, to the divine spirit which became man, to the Logos, Christ. In this sense, enlightenment was for Philo and those who thought like him the birth of Christ within the world of spirit. The Neoplatonic philosophy, which developed contemporaneously with Christianity, was an elaboration of Philo's thought. Let us see how Plotinus, 204 to 269 AD, describes his spiritual experiences. Quote, "Often when I come to myself on awaking from the sleep of my bodily nature, and turning from the outer world enter into myself, I behold wondrous beauty. Then I am sure that I have been conscious of the better part of myself. I live my true life. I am one with the divine, and rooted in the divine, gain the power to transport myself beyond even the superworld. After thus resting in God, when I descend from spiritual vision and again form thoughts, I ask myself how it has happened that I now descend and that my soul ever entered the body at all, since in her essence she is what she has just revealed herself to me. What can the reason be for souls forgetting God the Father, since they come from the beyond and belong to him, and when they forget him know nothing of him or of themselves? The first false step they take is indulging in presumption, the desire to become, and in forgetfulness of their true self, and in the pleasure of only belonging to themselves. They coveted self-glorification. They rushed about in pursuit of their desires, and thus went astray and fell completely away. Thereupon they lost all knowledge of their origin in the beyond, just as children, early separated from their parents and brought up elsewhere, do not know who they themselves and their parents are." Unquote. Plotinus delineates the kind of life the soul should strive to develop. Quote, "The life of the body and its longings should be stilled. The soul should find calm in all that surrounds her, in earth, sea, air, and heaven itself, no movement. She should learn to see how the soul pours herself from without into the serene cosmos, streaming into it from all sides. As the sun's rays illuminate a dark cloud and make it golden, so does the soul, on entering the body of the world, encircled by the heavens, give it life and immortality. End quote. It is evident that this world conception has a profound similarity to Christianity. Believers of the community of Christ said, quote, "That which has occurred from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled, of the word of life, declare we unto you." Unquote. In the same way it might be said in the spirit of Neoplatonism, "That which has occurred from the beginning, which cannot be heard and seen, must be spiritually experienced as the word of God, the word of life." There was an end quote thereafter, "declare we unto you," sorry. And so the development of the old world conception suffers a split. It leads in Neoplatonism and similar systems to an idea of Christ that is purely spiritual. On the other hand, it leads to a fusion of the idea of Christ with an historical manifestation, the personality of Jesus. The writer of the Gospel of St. John may be said to have united these two conceptions, quote, "in the beginning was the Word," unquote. He shares this conviction with the Neoplatonists. The Word becomes spirit within the soul, thus do the Neoplatonists conclude. The Word was made flesh in Jesus, thus does St. John conclude, and with him the whole Christian community. The inner meaning of the manner in which the Word alone could be made flesh was made clear through the whole development of ancient cosmogonies. Plato says of the macrocosm, "God has extended the soul of the world on the body of the world in the form of a cross." The soul of the world is the Logos. If the Logos is to be made flesh, he must recapitulate the cosmic process in fleshly existence. The Logos must be nailed to the cross and rise again. In spiritual form, this most momentous thought of Christianity had long before been prefigured in the old cosmogonies. The mystic went through it as a personal experience at initiation. The Logos become man had to go through it as a fact valid for the whole of humanity. Something which was present in the development of ancient wisdom as an incident in the mysteries becomes an historical fact through Christianity. Hence Christianity was the fulfillment not only of what the Jewish prophets had predicted, but also of the truth prefigured in the mysteries. The cross on Golgotha is the mystery cult of antiquity epitomized in a fact. We find the cross first in the ancient cosmogonies. At the starting point of Christianity, it confronts us in a unique event intended for the whole of mankind. It is from this point of view that reason is able to apprehend the mystical element in Christianity. Christianity, as mystical fact, is a milestone in the process of human evolution, and the incidents in the mysteries, with their attendant results, are the preparation for that mystical fact. The end of chapter 12. Chapter 13. St. Augustine and the Church. The full force of the conflict enacted in the souls of Christian believers during the transition from paganism to the new religion is revealed in the person of St. Augustine, 354 to 430 A.D. The spiritual struggles of Origen, Clement of Alexandria, Gregory Nazianzen, Jerome and others are revealed to us in a mysterious way when we see them quietly assimilated in the mind of Augustine. In Augustine's personality, out of a passionate nature, deep spiritual needs developed. He passed through pagan and semi-Christian ideas. He suffered deeply from the most appalling doubts, such as attack, one who has felt the impotence of thoughts in the face of spiritual problems, and who has tasted the depressing effect of the question, quote, "Can man know anything whatever?" Unquote. At the beginning of his struggles, Augustine's thoughts clung to the perishable things of sense. He could only picture the spiritual to himself in material images. It is a deliverance for him when he rises above this stage. He thus describes it in his confessions, quote, "When I wished to think of God, I could only imagine quantities of matter, and believed that was the only kind of thing that could exist. This was the chief and almost the only cause of error which I could not avoid," unquote. He thus indicates the point at which a person must arrive who is seeking the true life of the Spirit. There are thinkers, not a few, who maintain that it is impossible to arrive at pure thought, free from any material admixture. These thinkers confuse what they feel bound to say about their own inner life with what is humanly possible. The truth is rather that it is only possible to arrive at higher cognition when thought has been liberated from all material things, when an inner life has been developed in which images of reality do not cease when their demonstration in sense impressions comes to an end. Augustine relates how he attained to spiritual vision. Everywhere he asked where the divine was to be found. Quote, "I asked the earth, and she said, I am not it. And all that was upon the earth said the same. I asked the ocean and the abysses and all that lives in them, which said, quote, we are not thy God, seek beyond us. Unquote. I asked the winds and the whole atmosphere and its inhabitants, said, quote, the philosophers who sought for the essence of things in us were under an illusion. We are not God. Unquote. I'm still in the quote, of course. I asked the sun, moon, and stars, which said, we are not God, whom thou seekest. End quote. And it came home to St. Augustine that there is only one thing which can answer his question about the divine, his own soul. The soul said, no eyes nor ears can impart to thee what is in me, for I alone can tell thee, and I tell thee in an unquestionable way. Quote, men may be doubtful whether vital force is situate in air or in fire, but who can doubt that he himself lives, remembers, understands, wills, thinks, knows, and judges? If he doubts, it is a proof that he is alive. He remembers why he doubts. He understands that he doubts. He will assure himself he thinks. He knows that he knows nothing. He judges that he must not accept anything hastily. Unquote. Outer things do not resist when their essence and existence are denied, but the soul does offer opposition. She could not be doubtful of herself unless she existed. By her doubt, she confirms her own existence. Quote, we are, and we recognize our being, and we love our own being and cognition. On these three points, no illusion in the garb of truth can trouble us, for we do not apprehend them with our bodily senses like external things. Unquote. Man learns about the divine by leading his soul to know herself as spiritual, so that she may find her way as a spirit into the spiritual world. Augustine had battled his way through to this knowledge. It was out of such an attitude of mind that there grew up among pagan peoples the desire to knock at the gate of the mysteries. In the age of Augustine, such convictions might lead to becoming a Christian. Jesus, the Logos, become man, had shown the path a soul must follow if she would attain to the goal of which she speaks when in communion with herself. In 385 A.D. at Milan, Augustine was instructed by St. Ambrose. All his doubts about the Old and New Testaments vanished when his teacher interpreted the most important passages, not merely in a literal sense, but, quote, by lifting the mystic veil by force of the Spirit, unquote. What had been guarded in the mysteries was embodied for Augustine in the historical tradition of the Gospels and in the community where that tradition was preserved. He comes by degrees to the conviction that, quote, the law of this tradition, which consists in believing what it has not proved, is moderate and without guile, unquote. He arrives at the idea, quote, who could be so blind as to say that the Church of the Apostles deserves to have no faith placed in it, when it is so loyal and is supported by the unanimity of so many brethren, when these have handed down their writings to posterity so conscientiously, and when the Church has so strictly maintained the succession of teachers down to our present bishops, unquote. Augustine's mode of thought told him that with the coming of Christ, conditions had set in for souls seeking the Spirit other than those which had previously existed. For him it was firmly established that in Christ Jesus had been revealed in outer historical fact that which the mystic had sought through preparation in the mysteries. One of his significant utterances is the following, quote, what is now called the Christian religion already existed among the ancients and was not lacking at the very beginning of the human race. When Christ appeared in the flesh, the true religion already in existence received the name of Christian, unquote. There were two ways possible for such a method of thought. One way maintains that if the human soul develops within her the forces which lead her to the knowledge of her true self, she will, if she only goes far enough, also learn to know the Christ and everything connected with him. This would have been a mystery wisdom enriched by the Christ event. The other way is that taken by Augustine, by which he became the great model for his successors. It consists in ceasing to develop one's own soul forces at a certain point, and in borrowing the conceptions connected with the coming of Christ from written accounts and oral traditions. Augustine rejected the first way as springing from pride of the soul. He thought the second was the way of true humility. Thus he says to those who wish to follow the first way, quote, "You could find peace in the truth, but for that humility is needed, which does not suit your proud neck." Unquote. On the other hand, he was filled with boundless inward happiness by the fact that since, quote, "the coming of Christ in the flesh," unquote, it was possible to say that every human soul can come to spiritual experience if she goes as far as she can in seeking within herself, and then, in order to attain to the highest, has confidence in what the written and oral traditions of the Christian Church tell us about the Christ and his revelation. He says on this point, quote, "What bliss, what abiding enjoyment of supreme and true good is offered us! What serenity, what a breath of eternity! How shall I describe it? It has been expressed as far as it could be by those great incomparable souls who we admit have beheld and still behold. We reach a point at which we acknowledge how true is what we have been commanded to believe, and how well and beneficently we have been brought up by our mother, the Church, and of what benefit was the milk given by the Apostle Paul to the little ones." Unquote. Footnote. It is beyond the scope of this book to give an account of the alternative method which has evolved from the mystery wisdom enriched through the Christ event. A presentation of this method will be found in my book, An Outline of Esoteric Science. End footnote. Whereas in pre-Christian times one who wished to seek the spiritual basis of existence was necessarily directed to the way of the mysteries, Augustine was able to say even to those souls who could find no such path within themselves, "Go as far on the path of knowledge as your human powers will carry you. Thence trust, parenthesis faith, parenthesis, will lead you up into the higher spiritual regions." It was only going one step further to say, "It is natural for the human soul only to be able to reach a certain degree of knowledge through its own powers. Thence it can advance further only through trust, through faith in written and oral tradition." This step was taken by the spiritual movement that assigned to cognition a certain sphere above which the soul could not rise by her own efforts. Everything beyond this domain was made an object of faith, which must be supported by written and oral tradition and by confidence in its representatives. Thomas Aquinas, the greatest teacher within the Church, 1224 to 1274, has set forth this doctrine in his writings in a variety of ways. His main point is that human knowledge can only attain to that which led Augustine to self-knowledge, to the certainty of the divine. The nature of the divine and its relation to the world is given by revealed theology, which is no longer accessible to man's own researches, but is, as the substance of faith, superior to all knowledge. The origin of this point of view may be studied in the world conception of John Scotus Erigena, who lived in the 9th century at the court of Charles the Bald, and who represents a natural transition from the earliest ideas of Christianity to the ideas of Thomas Aquinas. His world conception is couched in the spirit of Neoplatonism. In his treatise De Divisione Natura, Erigena had elaborated the doctrine of Dionysus the Areopagite. This doctrine started from a god far above the perishable things of sense, and it derived the world from him. Man is involved in the transmutation of all beings into this God, who finally attains to what he was from the beginning. Everything reverts to the Godhead, which has passed through the universal process and has finally become perfected. But man, in order to reach this goal, must find the way to the Logos that was made flesh. In Erigena, this thought leads to another. What is contained in the writings giving an account of the Logos leads, when received in faith, to salvation. Reason and the authority of the Scriptures, faith and knowledge, stand on the same level. The one does not contradict the other, but faith must bring that to which knowledge never can attain by itself. Knowledge of the eternal, withheld in the mysteries from the multitude, became for this mode of thought, through the Christian attitude, the substance of faith, which by its very nature had to do with something unattainable by mere knowledge. The conviction of the pre-Christian mystic was that to him was given knowledge of the divine, while the people were obliged to have faith in its expression in images. Christianity came to the conviction that God has given his wisdom to mankind through revelation, and man attains through his insight an image of this divine revelation. The wisdom of the mysteries is a hothouse plant revealed to a few individuals who are ripe for it. Christian wisdom is a mystery revealed as knowledge to none, but as a content of faith to all. The standpoint of the mysteries lived on in Christianity, but in a different form. All, not only the special individual, were to share in the truth. But this was to occur in such a way that at a certain point, man recognized his inability to penetrate farther by means of knowledge, and thence ascended to faith. Christianity brought the content of the mysteries out of the obscurity of the temple into the clear light of day. The one spiritual stream within Christianity designated led to the idea that this content must necessarily be retained in the form of faith. And that is the end of the book Christianity as Mystical Fact by Rudolf Steiner.